7A, P450 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Julius Burton. And the first person is Attorney Esther Lee, representing Julius Burton. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Esther Cohn Lee with the law firm of James Hall in Milwaukee, and I represent the defendant appellant, Julius Burton. The main issue in this case, from which all of the other issues flow, is whether a defendant who has pled not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, and who has legitimate evidence to support that defense, has the right to know that he may plead guilty to the charges against him and still have a jury trial to decide his defense. And I would argue that the legislature, which gave him this right in Section 971.165, meant for him to know about that right, otherwise the statute would be meaningless. And if the defendant has the right to know that information, then the next two issues deal with the role of defense counsel and the role of the trial court to tell him that he has that right and to obtain a waiver of it. So I'd like to begin with the role of defense counsel. This case has gotten all the way to this court, and the record still does not show whether the defense counsel had ever told the defendant that he could plead guilty to the charges and still have a jury trial to decide his defense. So I would argue...
Was that really a choice? I mean, wasn't the plea that was made to a charge and the NGI defense would be withdrawn? So did he really have that choice to accept a plea and still go forward on the NGI?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. That the defendant has a choice of doing one of three things.
Under the statute, I agree. But when he gets a plea from the state, either has to accept it or reject it, doesn't he? And if the plea, part of the plea is giving up on the NGI, how does he have a right to go forward?
Well, the fact is, what the record isn't showing is that he knew that he could plead guilty to the charges and still have a trial to decide whether or not he should be held responsible due to mental disease or defect. So I would say, even though that the district attorney made him an offer, he could accept that offer, but at some point, the record has to show that defense attorney told him, well, wait a minute, you could plead guilty and still perhaps not go to prison, but instead go to a mental hospital if a jury finds you not guilty by reason...
Let me put it to you differently, because I'm probably not saying it very well. Could the district attorney, as part of a plea, require that he give up the NGI defense as part of the package that they're talking about? Could the district attorney require that, or can he never require that?
I would say he could require, but somewhere on the record, there has to be some indication that the defendant knew that by giving up, by pleading guilty and giving up his defense, he's also giving up his right to a jury trial on that defense.
It's the right word that bothers me, the word right, okay? And what I'm looking at is, when you have a plea, if the district attorney could require him to give up the NGI, if, then there's no right if he accepts the deal.
Well, the problem, though, is, Your Honor, he could accept the deal, but somehow he has to be able to say, I'm accepting this deal knowing that I could have had a trial on this if I had asked for it.
Well, perhaps...
That's what the record is missing.
Well, perhaps the way to handle this is, if I understand what you're saying, what you're saying is, he could waive his right to plead not guilty by reason of the NGI plea. But if he's going to waive it, waiver requires a full understanding and knowledge, right? And you're saying he couldn't have a full understanding and knowledge because he wasn't told that he could plead guilty and keep an NGI plea.
Right.
Is
that what you?
Yes.
Okay, so we're focusing on waiver and knowing and intelligent voluntary relinquishment of that.
Counsel, he withdrew his entry of an NGI plea and instead entered a guilty plea, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, just to kind of walk through this, you get the complaint or you get the information, you enter a plea. The plea can be guilty, the plea can be not guilty, the plea can be NGI. And you can enter any of those. But when you enter one of those, the court doesn't say, well, gee, you're entering this, but you're not entering that. Is there a reason why you're not doing an NGI in this particular case? But he withdrew his NGI. It's not as if the court took a plea on the NGI, right?
Well, here's what I think the problem is, Your Honor. He pled originally not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. At some point later on, defense counsel comes in and tells the court the defendant wishes to withdraw that defense.
Right. But that plea, not that defense, but that plea. He withdrew that plea and instead entered a guilty plea. So then the issue is he knowingly, freely, and voluntarily entering a guilty plea? But you want it to be the court needs to make a finding that he's knowingly, freely, and voluntarily withdrawing his NGI.
Right,
as
because
I understand your
think
argument.
The issue here is, Your Honor, that the not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect involves the right to a jury trial.
Well, so does a not guilty plea.
Right, and before a defendant may withdraw his not guilty plea, the court has to say to him on the record, I'm getting to the court's role, Rath.
I mean, I understand what a court has to do with respect to that. But what you're asking this court to find is that with NGI pleas, once they're entered, before someone can withdraw that, the court needs to go through a special colloquy on what you get to do if you have a trial in an NGI.
Right. Well,
okay.
I think I'm going to first concentrate on the role of defense counsel here. That I want to say that defense counsel has to say to the court on the record the defendant is withdrawing his plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, and he knows that by doing so, he's also waiving his right to a jury trial on that defense. And that's what I feel that is missing from this record. So when the defendant filed his post-conviction motion, we asked the circuit court to hold a Mockner hearing so at least we could have on the record testimony from the two defense attorneys as to whether they told him that he had this right. And I would argue that if defense counsel did not tell him that he had that right, that that constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel.
No, but the difference is, I mean, the court went through and the plea questioner goes through your right to a jury trial where all 12 jurors have to agree as to whether you're guilty or not guilty. What you want that, you want the plea questioner and you want the form to change and you want the colloquy to change to make sure that in an NGI situation, it goes further than the plea colloquy that we've traditionally accepted and say, you know, you have the right to have a two-phase trial and the right to trial would be this on the first phase, this on the second phase, and the jurors would all have to come to an agreement with respect to each phase of the proceeding. And then, you know, when you withdraw your NGI, you aren't requiring a two-phase jury. I mean, you want a further colloquy, and you want, really, the plea questionnaire to change, too, I think.
Well, I would say that when there is a case involving this defense, it's like no other case, because no other case involves a jury trial, a separate jury trial, to decide just the defense. So merely pleading guilty is not saying that he's waiving his right to have a jury decide whether he's guilty or not. But that's not saying that he's waiving his right to have the jury decide his defense, which is a separate issue.
But when you withdraw your NGI plea, there's no plea that remains other than the one he entered, which was guilty, and the court's duty was to know he was entering a guilty.
Right.
I understand what you're saying. It's kind of interesting because NGIs are a different animal, really, when it comes to, you know, trial rights and how they proceed. Mm-hmm. But
you see, he's withdrawing the defense But he's not withdrawing the defense knowing that he still has this right.
Well, it's a plea. It's not really a defense. It's a plea.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'm going to argue that it's a defense. The defense of mental disease or defect is an affirmative defense, but it's a defense. And by withdrawing it, he's withdrawing his right to have a jury decide that defense.
Why shouldn't the court have to go through every defense and make sure the person knows they're giving up their right to have a jury decide every defense then, assuming you're right?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
that. If you have the right to a defense in, you know, a defense of third person, should the court go through and say, oh gosh, I know you're entering a guilty plea, but you have this defense. And your defense, you know, do you know you're giving that up and the jury would have to reach a conclusion?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I think that is the case, that if a person has, for example, a defense of self-defense, ordinarily in the cases I see that the trial court says, do you realize you have the defense of self-defense and that by pleading guilty, you're waiving that defense? I mean, that usually is in there.
So you're asking really that line of cases be followed with respect to this. Is that right?
I just would say that this is a different animal.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out what exactly you're asking and what the basis is.
Okay.
Counsel, in response to a question asked by the Chief Justice, she made reference to, and you're saying, trying to summarize your position, are you saying he wasn't told that he could plead guilty to the crime and still have a jury trial on the NGI? And you essentially responded yes. But I want to know if that's what you are really saying. Are you really saying that he wasn't told that he could have this jury trial on the NGI? Or are you saying that the record doesn't reflect that he was told?
Well, the record doesn't reflect that he was told. We don't know from the record if he was told.
How do you get around, I think it's, I have it here, paragraph 39. You don't have to look at paragraph 39 in Brown because you know the case of State versus Brown. And the idea that a defendant must file a post-conviction motion alleging defendant did not know or understand the information that should have been provided at the plea hearing.
Well,
when I read through your motion, I didn't see that.
Well, here's the way I would argue that, Your Honor, that the defendant, I don't feel the defendant has to submit an affidavit saying I didn't know this, because even if he did, we still want to know what the defense attorneys would say about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the two defense attorneys, if they didn't tell him about this right, I would say that that's not only ineffective assistance of counsel, but it may even be malpractice. And I don't feel we have to submit an affidavit from the attorneys admitting malpractice before he's entitled to a hearing in this case. What would be the purpose of having the hearing if the defense attorneys submitted the affidavit?
What's the purpose of having a hearing if the defendant knew anyway, regardless of whether or not his attorneys told him, or regardless of whether or not the record reflects that his attorneys told him? Isn't that just form over substance? If from another source, the defendant knew that he had the right?
Well, suppose, Your Honor, that we had submitted an affidavit from the defendant. He says, they never told me about this. The court would not be satisfied with that. They would want to know, what did the attorneys say to him? Did they not tell him? They'd want to know that.
What do you think it means when the Brown case says that the defendant must allege that the defendant did not know or understand the information? How do you fulfill that requirement in Brown of alleging that you did not know or understand the information?
Well, I think that I would say that the record would have to show, the record has to show it. And here the record does not show it. I mean, I read through every single transcript, all the documents. I went to the attorney's offices and got their documents, and there's nothing that showed that he had ever been told that. So I think that's what's missing in the record here. Also, if I can continue on then with the role of the defense counsel, I mean the role of the court, even if defense counsel had told him about this right, I would argue that the defendant was still entitled to have his plea set aside because the court had not carried out its duty in regard to this defense. Because I feel that the court should have, at the very least, said to him, when the attorney says, I wish to withdraw your plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, that the court should have said to him, look, you have the right to have a jury trial decide that defense, even if you wish to plead guilty. And if the defendant then says, no, I still wish to, I understand I have that defense, and I wish to plead guilty, I wish to waive that defense, then the court, I would say, has to go through this colloquy with him to make certain that he understands that he has the right to the jury trial and that he's voluntarily waiving that right.
Well, it does seem that that's what you're left. You argue that because that's what you're left with, because certainly the transcript of the plea hearing indicates that between the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorneys, a very thorough job was done in having a colloquy with your client to indicate that he was knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily giving up his right to present the NGI defense.
But Your Honor, if you, the transcripts...
Except for the portion, well, I mean, I don't think I have to go through all these. A few of them, page 13, the court, you talked with your attorney about entering. In fact, I believe you did enter a plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, correct? Mr. Burton, yes. The court, you are withdrawing that plea at this time, correct? Mr. Burton, yes. The court, and you are also giving up the right, as I mentioned, the right challenging various other things. And then we go on, Mr. Williams, the prosecutor, says, Judge, there is a doctor that found Mr. Burton would render that opinion that Mr. Burton was not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. I'm assuming that Mr. Burton read that report, knows that report is available, and that he has two competent lawyers that would present that if the matter did go to trial. There also is at least one doctor that finds Mr. Burton did understand that he was doing at the time and would contradict that opinion. But Mr. Burton is aware that there is an opinion from a doctor that he would, that he was not guilty by mental disease or defect at the time, and he is waiving that right to present that defense. The court, counsel, have you had that discussion with your client? Mr. Lavoie, yes, the doctor, and then we go on. And then, in fact, the court asks defense counsel's opinion about his current competency. The court, and counsel, we also had a competency evaluation early on, and do you have any reason to question? And the defendant was found to be competent to proceed. Do you have any reason to question his competency at this time? Mr. Lavoie, I do not, judge. Every time I visit with him, I can ask him if he's been receiving his medication and taking his medication, and each time he indicates he's receiving his medication and has been taking it properly. He's been oriented to be able to discuss the case with us. That is why I have no concerns about competency at this time. So it seems to me what you're left with is exactly what you're arguing, which is it is not enough for the court to go through the colloquy to ask if he is knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waiving his right to present the NGI defense, but the very specific right to present the issue of NGI, which is a subset of the defense, to the jury. Because the first part would be, of course, the entry of the finding of guilt of the actual commission of the offense. Then the second part could be tried to the jury as to the NGI. That is what the very specific focus of your request is, because it seems to me everything else was pretty well covered.
Well, Your Honor, the fact is, I guess I would ask this question. How could a defendant knowingly and intelligently waive the NGI defense without knowing that he could have had a jury trial on it?
And that's your whole case.
Right. That, that you know, this court has several times held that before there can be a waiver of a jury trial, or before there can be a plea of guilty, for example, the court must tell him, you have the right to have a jury.
12 citizens unanimously right. decide whether you're guilty. Are you knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily giving that up? Has anyone made any threats or promises to induce you to give right. that right up?
And so here the court did say that. You know you have the right to a jury trial to decide whether or not you're guilty.
Right.
The court did not go on to say, even if you give up that right, you have the right to a jury trial to decide whether you should be held responsible. And that's what's missing here.
And maybe you can see that your argument might be a little stronger if he was actually going forward with the NGI plea, but waiving his right to a jury on that aspect.
Waiving his right to a jury on the NGI? Well, then we've come to another statute, Your Honor, that 972.02 that says if you waive your right to a jury trial and you instead want a bench trial, for example, on that defense, you must put that in writing and it must be a statement on open court, in open court. You don't have that here.
Right, because he wasn't doing that.
He wasn't doing it because I'm saying he didn't possibly know about it.
Because he switched his plea.
Right, but he switched his plea. I guess my whole point is, Your Honor, that he switched his plea and there is nothing to show that he knew that, oh, wait a minute, I could accept my responsibility as the defense counsel said, admit that I had shot these two police officers, but I still want a trial on my defense.
Yep.
Could I, you want a hearing, in a sense, a Mockner hearing?
Yes.
Okay, and who has the burden of proof there?
Well, I suppose we do, that we have to show that there is something missing from the record that needs to be placed in the record in order for the court to make the decision in the case.
Okay.
So here I'm saying, Your Honor, that this court and the Court of Appeals could not determine ineffective assistance of counsel if we don't have that record. And they couldn't determine whether his plea had been voluntarily made without that record.
Well, the defendant had two attorneys
yes.
Leading up to the plea.
They are from the same law office.
Okay. Did they tell the defendant about his right to a bifurcated situation, what you're alleging?
There does not appear that they did, Your Honor, from the record.
But now you have the burden of proving that they didn't.
It's kind of a catch-22. How do I request a Mockner hearing? What would be the use of having the Mockner hearing if they admitted it?
You know? If I never was a trial judge, but if you were making this motion to me and you're saying, Judge, I want to hold a hearing. Now, I know you have the burden of proof. Don't you have to at least allege that the defendant had attorney A and had attorney B, and neither one of them told the defendant such and such, and the defendant didn't know that? Yeah, if you did that, now I gotta sit up and take notice of that. But that isn't what you've alleged here, is it?
Well, I think there are some cases, Your Honor, that talk about the fact that you cannot assume from a silent record that the defendant knew about his right to a jury trial. And that's what I'm saying here. Can't assume from the silent record that he knew. And the only way we can know that is to have a hearing and let these two attorneys testify.
Was Judge Martin's wrong in his decision and order? Did he misstate the record in his decision and order?
In what regard, Your Honor?
The one dated February 14, 2011, where he went through it seemed to me, he went through the record, you know, extensive record made during the plea hearing about the defendant's desire to withdraw his plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. What Judge McMahon specifically asked if he wanted to withdraw that plea, he said he did. Attorney Lavoie said he and Attorney Kim explained to the defendant that the experts were retained and prepared to testify in his favor. This is a direct quote, but he informed us he wishes to accept responsibility by entering the pleas. The court pressed on to ensure the defendant had enough time to talk to his lawyers about his options. The state inquired if the defendant was aware of Dr. Linden's report and if he had perused it. Attorney Lavoie responded, said that he reviewed the report word for word with the defendant, then continued, and this is a quote, he's aware of her opinion, he's aware that she'd be prepared to testify if necessary, but he indicated to me again he wishes to accept responsibility and forego that issue. He's also aware of the other options that have been presented here by the doctors referenced by the state. So it's my opinion that his position is he wishes to resolve the case today with a plea. The court then asked the defendant if he had heard what Attorney Lavoie said and disagreed with any of it. The defendant responded, no. The court further inquired, and you specifically talked about your right to raise that particular defense of mental disease or defect, correct? The defendant responded, yes. And then, you know, Judge Martins, anyway, says, based on the extensive record made, there's nothing, and he emphasizes nothing, that demonstrates that he, you know, abandoned his NGI without a reason. So was Judge Martins wrong, or if I'm understanding you correctly, you just wanted the court to go further and say, you know, on that second phase, 12 people would have to hear the evidence?
In other words, I would say, Your Honor, I think this is what's most troubling about this, that Dr. Lighton had prepared this very lengthy report showing that, yes, he was psychotic at the time of the shooting, and that he could not control his actions, and that the defendant did not know that he could present that defense, present her report, even if he pled guilty to the charges. See, all the things that you read talk about, yes, he admits that he did the crime, he understands that there was this report by Dr. Lighton, but he was never told that, well, you can do both things. You can both plead guilty and have this jury trial.
What about the quote, and you specifically talked about your right to raise that particular defense of mental disease or defect, correct? The defendant responded, correct. What's missing there?
What's missing is that he was never told he could have the court had kind of said to him, by pleading guilty, you are waiving your right to your defense. And what the defendant was not told was, no, by pleading guilty, you're pleading guilty, you're not necessarily waiving your right to have a jury trial about it.
If he still had his NGI plea entered, you'd have to go into that second phase about what you want to do with the second part of it. But he withdrew that, so the court was taking a guilty plea. And so the question is, did he withdraw his NGI and knowingly, freely, and voluntarily enter a guilty plea?
I guess that's where I wish that the court had gone further. That it bothers me the fact that he is withdrawing his plea. Actually, the defense attorney withdrew it, and then the court asked him, do you know you're withdrawing the plea? But
the court said, and you specifically talked with your lawyer about your right to raise the defense of mental disease or defect, correct? He says yes.
But there's nothing there that says you can't, you can still do that, even admitting your guilt. You see what's missing there?
Well, if you have an NGI plea, that is what you do. You have to do the two phases. You first decide if you're guilty or not, and then you have the NGI phase. And people often enter a plea to the guilt part and proceed only to trial on the NGI. But that wasn't before the court because he withdrew all that.
He withdrew it not knowing that he could do that. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Thank you.
So, your red light's been on. You'll have a 5 minutes in rebuttal. I should have asked if anyone else had any questions before you sat down. But hearing none, Assistant Attorney General Sally L. Wellman, arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is the plaintiff respondent. First of all, we would ask this court to hold that the circuit court properly denied Burton's post-conviction motion without an evidentiary hearing because the motion did not allege sufficient facts to require an evidentiary hearing on either the ineffective assistance of counsel claim or the defective plea colloquy claim. This court, if you don't actually have to go any further than that, you could end this case there. If you choose to go further, we would also ask you to reject his claim that, as I understand it, is that when a defendant has entered a plea of not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity or not responsible by reason of mental defect, and then elects to enter a plea agreement to plead to the charged crimes in exchange for a favorable sentence recommendation by the state, the trial court must advise the defendant on the record during the plea colloquy that he has the option to reject the plea agreement, plead guilty to the charged crimes, and still have a jury trial on his insanity plea, and that even though Burton waived his right to a jury trial during the plea colloquy, and there was a thorough colloquy in which he made it very clear he understood, he was also waiving his insanity defense, and that's what he wanted to do, the trial court was nonetheless required to obtain a separate and distinct waiver of his right to a jury trial on the insanity issue.
You want the court to say that?
You want the court to reject that position. That's my understanding of the defendant's position.
Verbs are important.
I know. I started out with saying we want the court to reject, but then I went on so long, you probably forgot I said that.
I just am recovering from my shock.
Yes. No, no. We want you to reject that.
You know, this is just wonderful, isn't it?
Communication is important, yeah. No, we would like the court to uphold Francis and, I mean, Francis, which is the Court of Appeals decision that the Court of Appeals here relied on properly, already holds that when a defendant has pled both not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity, and then comes in and pursuant to a plea agreement pleads guilty, the court doesn't have to hold any kind of colloquy whatsoever on the insanity aspect.
Read footnote 5.
The court did, I believe that's the footnote that says, exactly. Even though it's not required, it's good to do.
We believe it nonetheless advisable for trial courts to engage in personal colloquy for at least two reasons. First, it helps satisfy the court that the defendant is aware and alert of what's going on. Second, the record is protected from later ineffective assistance of counsel claims where a convicted defendant might assert that counsel never discussed the NGI withdrawal.
Right, and certainly there was a very, very thorough colloquy here on the NGI aspect. Nonetheless, as I understand Mr. Burton, he's saying that still isn't good enough because you didn't separately, distinctly tell me that I could reject the plea agreement and plead guilty and still have a trial on the not guilty by insanity defense that I've already told you that I want to waive in order to get the benefit of this plea agreement. I don't see any basis. There's certainly no constitutional basis, and she doesn't seem to really argue that. And I don't understand how it can become something the trial court is required to do simply because it's in the statute as an option, because lots and lots of things are in the statute as possibilities and options, and we don't require the trial court to tell the defendant all of those. If her theory is that because it's a plea option that you're waiving by entering this other plea, then it seems to me that we'd have to say, well, a trial court, whenever a defendant comes in and wants to plead guilty pursuant to a plea agreement or otherwise, the court has to stop him and say, no, wait, do you understand that the statute also gives you the option to plead no contest? And this is how no contest plea is different from a guilty plea. And do you understand that you're giving up that option by choosing this option?
Counsel? A former justice on this court, Justice Babbage, used to talk about statutory due process. And what he was indicating with that phrase
is that even though there are not constitutional rights, and of course the Francis case indicates there's no fundamental constitutional right to have what's requested here, that even though there isn't a constitutional right, there is a statutory right. And if you are given a statutory right, there has to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of that statutory right. That's what he referred to as statutory due process. And indeed, the defendant here is arguing, uses the word due process in some of the argument. So let me try that. Is there a statutory right to a jury trial on the NGI phase? It seems to me there is. Am I wrong?
I think there is. It's not express.
Yeah.
But it's referred to in 971-65, and it's certainly been treated that way in the case law.
Okay, so we have a statutory right. And the thesis, as I understand it, of your opposing counsel's argument is if you have a statutory right, may not be constitutional, maybe it is, but in her argument, but statutory right, that a knowing relinquishment of that right should be demonstrated. And it's not, and she would argue, opposing counsel argues, and it's not demonstrated here. So what's wrong with that argument? We have, in other contexts, statutory rights that I think may not be constitutional, but due process requires that the defendant be advised, a la the citizen deportation.
Right, but I have several responses. First of all, if Justice Babich is saying that for all statutory rights, there is this requirement of a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver simply because the statutory right has been created by the legislature, I would strenuously disagree with that because that is, you know, so broad. There certainly is a procedural due process aspect to when a even if you don't have to give someone a right, if once you do, you can't arbitrarily take it away. But that's a totally different animal. The other thing is, I think here, the fact that he was given the statutory right, I don't know how you would differentiate this from other statutory rights. For example, you have a statutory right, if you want a jury trial, then you have a statutory right to peremptory challenges to potential jurors. You have a statutory right to a lesser included offense if the legal requirements are made. We don't go through all of those things. We require the trial court to go through all those things the defendant is giving up by entering a guilty plea.
No, but this, the phrase different animal has been used a couple of times. This, there is no statutory right to a jury trial on getting some of the, let's say, the right to exculpatory evidence. There is no statutory right to a jury trial on the issue of whether or not you're getting exculpatory evidence as requested. There is, however, a statutory right to a jury trial on NGI.
Right, and the reason for that statutory right, I think we need to, you know, go back to the basics too and talk, why do we have a bifurcated trial process and a right to a jury trial on the NGI? And the bifurcated trial process is to protect the defendant's self-incrimination rights so that we don't have one trial where incriminating statements and admissions he made to the experts in the insanity defense come in at the guilt phase to prove he's guilty. And that purpose is, you know, is served. It has nothing to do with giving him a separate trial for any other purpose. I mean, it's a protective of the defendant, but once he's chosen, I'm going to take this deal. Now, granted, in this case, he didn't get the recommendation that, the sentence the state recommended, but he knew when he entered the deal that the court didn't have to give him that sentence, and it didn't. He knew he was waiving his not guilty by reason of insanity defense and taking this deal instead.
Yeah,
and
the whole thing that the opposing counsel is arguing is, but he didn't know that he had the right to have a jury trial, a statutory right to have a jury trial on that NGI, and as a result, be found not guilty.
Well, actually, that brings us full circle back to the procedural argument at the beginning, because that's not what Mr. Burton is saying, or did, not what he said in his post-conviction motion. He never said, trial counsel did not tell me that I had the statutory option to plead guilty and still have a jury trial on the insanity plea defense. He did not say I did not know that.
Now you're going back to your,
right,
your fail-safe position of insufficient averments in the complaint.
Right. Which is extremely failure. Important.
Yeah.
Extremely
but I was
important.
On the other one that was
right.
A little more tentative.
Right. But, you know, he's not saying that, and he's also not saying, in the ineffective assistance claim, he just to finish that procedural thought, he also has to show his alleged facts showing as prejudicial, which means that he has to affirmatively say, which he didn't, not only I would not have accepted the plea agreement, entered the guilty plea, and given up my insanity defense and insanity jury trial if I had known of this third option, and here's why. And that critical here's why is missing here. He seems to concede he knew he had a right to a jury trial of the case, the criminal case. He knowingly he waived that on the record after a thorough colloquy. He knew he had entered an insanity defense. He knew he had an expert report that supported that, and the state had reports and experts that would not support that. He knowingly gave that up. He, knowing all of that, he gives us no explanation whatsoever for why, knowing all that, if he'd only known that he also had the statutory option to plead guilty and still have a guilty trial, a jury trial on insanity, why he wouldn't have done that.
Well, he wouldn't have had a plea agreement.
Right, he'd have to give up the plea agreement. And, you know, he conveniently ignores that throughout briefing. Is he would have to give up that, what he saw at the time, and it was a favorable sentence recommendation. Serious sentence recommendation, but still very favorable given the facts and charges in this case. The other thing I just wanted to make sure that I point out is there's two distinct arguments going on here. One is ineffective assistance of counsel, and one is the trial court's duty. We don't believe the trial court doesn't have a duty to have the colloquy that she's suggesting and get the separate waiver of a jury trial on the insanity defense. And there's no basis to create that, for this court to create that. But she seems to be, as I understand it, defense counsel is also saying, well, he gets a hearing and he gets relief if the record, or he gets a hearing at least, if the record doesn't show that defense counsel told him this as a standalone ineffective assistance of counsel argument. And that's just wrong. We don't expect the plea colloquy for defense counsel to tell the trial court everything that they discussed with the defendant and all of the options.
Ms. Wellman, on the averments of the defendant regarding a defect in the plea colloquy, I think you'd look at Brown and Bangert and some other cases that say, here's what the defendant has to say in his motion. And it's, you just have to copy it from those cases. I mean, you hope that it's true and that the affidavit is truthful, but now, what case do you rely on that on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you have to aver what counsel did and the prejudicial effect? Is that the Mochner case itself?
That's Bentley, and Allen repeats it, and more recently, Balliet, is that how you pronounce it, on the post-conviction appeal levels. So, I mean, that's... I think that's absolutely clear that you have to do that. And it's equally clear he did not in this motion. He did not allege that he was not told. He did not allege he didn't know. He did not allege he would have what he would have done differently and give the court facts that show why he would have done differently so that the court has a basis to assess that. And as to the alleged defective plea colloquy, although he alleged the trial court did not tell me about this third option and get a separate jury waiver of the statutory right to jury trial on insanity. He did not allege that he did not know that, and that's fatal to his post-conviction motion.
Well, as to, that's the procedural part.
Right, right.
As to what kind of colloquy you should have under Bangor Brown and the statute, the judge knows, the trial court knows there's been a plea of NGI, right?
Right.
It's on the record.
Right.
Judge may or may not know there's a self-defense that's going to be pled or some other defense in this. But the judge has on the record an NGI plea. And when that happens, that doesn't that put the trial court on alert that, one, you're going to have a withdrawal. And once you have a withdrawal of this kind of plea, and you have a statute about withdrawing the plea and waiving this defense, that maybe you should clean up the record and make sure that it's understood. There's a very good long plea colloquy here, and it talks at great length about defenses, but I didn't see a particular reference to the NGI plea and any defenses that relate to that until the end when the lawyers bring up the reports and he's told, and maybe that's good enough. But it seems to me that it is good practice and it should be part of the colloquy. It's not constitutional. I mean, for the moment, no one's arguing it is, and St. Francis says no. That if you're going to have a waiver of this sort, of this kind of plea, it should be on the record and knowingly and intelligently given by questioning the guy. That's just very different from lesser included offenses and the other very good examples you gave.
I don't disagree that it may be good practice. It's frustrating a little bit in this case because one of the reasons that Francis suggests that it's a good practice is that we would avoid these kind of challenges, but here we still are.
Because it wasn't direct and specific and et cetera.
Well, the only thing that wasn't specific was, do you know you have the right to plead guilty or the option to plead
jury
guilty
trial
and still have the jury trial on this? And it seems to me that, you know, if he knows he's giving up his jury trial altogether, he knows he's giving up his insanity defense altogether, I don't think it would be critical for the court to do that. I also think if the court is considering adding a court, you know, mandate, I guess you wouldn't have to overrule Francis because you could say Francis is correct, there's no constitutional obligation to do this, but hereafter we're requiring a court mandate. I would urge the court to make it extremely clear, and I'm not suggesting that we agree that you should do this because I don't think it's necessary, but if you do, I think you have to make it extremely clear for the trial court's benefit, how much does the court have to tell the defendant? I mean, is it enough to say you're giving up this defense and this plea? Does he have to also get a separate voluntary and knowing and intelligent waiver of the statutory jury trial on that? Do you have to tell the defendant, do you realize that if you pursue an insanity plea, you have the burden of proof? Do you realize that the court may nonetheless admit evidence of what happened, the facts of the crime, because they'll be relevant to the mental responsibility determination? Do you realize that you have a statutory option to waive the jury trial and try the insanity defense to the trial court only, but the state has to consent to that? I mean, there are all of these statutory provisions that go along, and if we're going to start saying you have to have a colloquy on this, I think it behooves us to tell the courts what that would be. And I also disagree that it's that fundamentally different. I mean, it is, we do have this bifurcated process, and again, that's to protect the defendant's self-incrimination rights. But in terms of consequences and impact on the defendant, an insanity plea, and this is another thing maybe the trial court should tell us, do you realize that you could be locked up in a mental institution for as long as you could be locked up in prison? But I digress. My point was that if, like, often self-defense will come up before trial. For example, there'll be motions to get in McMorris evidence, evidence about prior bad acts or what the defendant knows about the dangerousness and violent character of the victim. And then he'll enter a plea. Well, he's giving up the right to self-defense. Well, that right to self-defense can have a much, in practical terms of incarceration or conviction, a much bigger impact on the defendant. And yet we don't require the courts to go through all of that.
No, we don't. But in this case, for example, there had been a motion to suppress.
That's right.
And the trial court, in a very good colloquy, said, you know, there's a motion pending. And the defendant answered yes. And then the trial court said, you're withdrawing your plea of NGI and not guilty, right. And you're also giving the right, as I mentioned, we have a motion hearing challenging the statements, and you're giving up the right to pursue that motion. Correct, yes. And you're giving up the right to pursue other motions you might have filed. Correct, etc. So, I mean, this judge did go through anything that was on the record that the court would be held to know. So the question is, was it specific enough here on the NGI?
Well, it certainly was, well, those things, you know, although the trial court do them, we certainly don't fault the court for doing them.
No, I'm not faulting.
But it was not required for the court to do that.
That's really the question in terms of it may not be required as to the colloquy, but it may be required for a record of knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver.
But right after that information about the motions, the court went further to talk about how a week prior he signed his forms and turned them in, and did he have a change of heart? Did he want to go ahead? Are you satisfied? He asked counsel, are you satisfied? He understands what he's doing. And counsel replied, yes, the Sheriff's Department provided both myself and Mr. Kim quite a bit of access to Mr. Burton. We've met with him a number of times about defenses, the trial issues, NGI issues, motions. I believe he's making the decision of his own free will. We've explained to Mr. Burton we retained experts. The experts are prepared to testify if necessary. But he's informed us he wishes to accept responsibility by entering pleas. I believe he's doing it of his own free will. The court then asks him, is this right? Is this what your lawyer did? He says, yeah. And then the court says, so you talked to your attorneys and they've represented you since the beginning? He says, yes. They talked to you about the various options? He says, yes. And then counsel, you satisfied that he knowingly, freely, and voluntarily is plea? Yes. And you know, there's a lot of discussion on this record, not just about motions, but about the options, the NGI, the experts, the opinions, and the whole time he acknowledges, I know what I'm doing. And counsel said, I mean, on this record, counsel said, we discussed all these things with him. So where is in the record something that says that they didn't? I mean, where is his assertion that they didn't? Because the record says they did.
Right, and our position is there isn't any, that, you know, he didn't allege it in his motion. And we're getting back to the procedure again, but the defense counsel's position that, well, we're in a catch-22 because how can we know if we can't call defense counsel and ask him? Well, what you need to allege is the defendant, there were two parties involved in whatever happened between counsel and client pre-trial. There was counsel and the client. You've got the client. It's the client's motion. He needs to at least be able to say, my attorneys never told me this. Whatever it is. My attorneys never told me this. I didn't know it. I didn't understand it. And if I had, here's what I would have done different, and here's why. For the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And for a claim of defective colloquy, although the colloquy here was not defective, he's asking this court to add new requirements that don't currently exist. He has to say not only, and that will be on the record, the trial court did not tell him specifically, you could plead guilty and have a jury trial on insanity defense. He also has to allege, I did not know that, and he did not allege that.
Were there experts retained for the guilty phase of the trial, or were the experts retained for the NGI part of the trial?
As I recall Dr. Lighton's report, who was the expert retained by the defense, she says in the report that she was asked to evaluate him regarding his ability to knowingly voluntarily waive his Miranda rights and to look at the not guilty by insanity plea. She did not mention any other aspect.
Wasn't there an expert counsel, an audio expert, who had submitted a report and was prepared to testify that the investigating detectives altered the audio recording of the defendant's statements?
Yes, and as I recall, the prosecutor responded that if there were a hearing, they would dispute that, they would refute that. And the prosecutor also said, we don't intend to admit his statement in our case in chief.
Yes, I understood the prosecutor to dispute it, but said it doesn't matter anyway because we're not going to use those statements.
Well, he just put him on notice. We don't intend to use. I mean, he could have still pursued that hearing had he wanted to.
Yes, but prosecutors contested that the investigators altered the audio statements of the defendant, but indicated that they weren't going to use those statements anyway.
Right.
The plea bargain, what was the state going to recommend?
The state recommended a global, meaning a sentence covering both charges, of a total of 50 years initial confinement, and made no recommendation on how much extended supervision time.
And the defendant was, about 20, 19, 20, something like that?
Yeah, he was about 20 at the time of sentencing.
But would that mean he wouldn't get out until he was 70?
Yes.
Why would a defendant agree to that if there was an arguable defense of mental illness?
I'm sorry, an arguable defense of?
What would be the motivation for the defendant to agree to a recommendation of a 50-year sentence?
I think under the horrendous facts of this case, where he shot two police officers in the face at close range who were simply trying to detain him and talk to him, and they suffered severe injuries, and he had two charges of attempted first-degree intentional homicide and a dangerous weapon enhancer, he was facing 90 years of incarceration. And so, as his defense attorney explained it at sentencing at the guilty plea hearing, made reference to it, this recommendation, if the court went along with it, would at least give him a chance to get out during his lifetime, whereas a greater sentence, which was certainly possible and in fact was imposed under these facts, would not. And even though he had one expert report that favored the insanity plea, he has the burden of proof on insanity. There's certainly no guarantee that he would be successful on that defense. Especially given some of the contradictions, and we set out the substance of both reports in our brief, and the different things they told different examiners, there's certainly no guarantee that he would have won on that. And so he faced the possibility that he would either plead or go to trial on the guilt phase, lose the insanity phase, and still be facing a much greater sentence and not get the benefit of saying, at least he could tell the trial court, and did at sentencing here, you know, I should get some credit because I spared the victims and their families having to go through a trial on this, and a trial on the insanity phase. So I think there was definitely a legitimate benefit to be gained by taking this plea agreement when it appears that he had no defense to the charged crimes as a practical matter. And although he did have an expert report, there were certainly serious weaknesses in that. So it was not at all a foregone conclusion that he could. In fact, I think there's serious doubt whether he could have won on the insanity phase.
Do you know where the defendant is now? What institution?
I do not. I'm assuming he's in prison because he was given a prison sentence. I don't know what institution he's in.
It seems to me the state has a very strong case on the procedural aspects. It is a little bit troubling that there are number of defendants in state institutions, criminal institutions, who are seriously mentally ill. That's sort of in the background for me here, whether there needs to be some more inquiry about what to do with those people. If I understand the law, if someone is convicted of a crime and they're seriously mentally ill, they cannot be shipped off to another state institution for treatment of the mentally ill. Am I wrong on that?
I'm not sure. There certainly is mental health treatment available in the prison. I mean, he could be prescribed medication in the prison, as I understand it. He could go through therapy and treatment in the prison. I thought that there was a provision that he could be temporarily sent to a mental institution if he was so seriously mentally ill in the prison that it was, you know, he needed immediate restorative treatment, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, the trial...
That may not be so.
In the plea colloquy, the trial judge asked the usual question of if you are in any medication. That's mm-hmm. to show competence at the plea hearing. But here, he was on medication, and the judge said, are you taking him, and do you have any objection to taking him, and do they make you feel better or worse? And he said, better. And then he goes on later in the colloquy to say, you know, you got mental health problems. And the defense counsel agrees with that, as does Burton. And so it's not like some cases, and maybe many cases, where the trial court's not put on alert about the mental health issues. And has to therefore take special cautions.
And the trial court did in this case.
Pardon me?
The trial court did, have a thorough colloquy, and at sentencing took that into account and took into account the fact that the defendant repeatedly would refuse to take his medications and reportedly was refusing at this time, shortly before this incident. And, I've read statistic, I can't quote them now, but I mean, I think a very, very large number of the people in our prisons do have some degree of mental health problems, personality disorders, mood disorders, and other mental health problems.
For the jails, too.
And the jails.
I don't want to belabor this, but mm-hmm. on a visit to Taycheedah, the women's prison near Fond du Lac, you take a tour of the prison, and you see what are appear to be normal people most of the time. There is a section in which there are women who are shackled to chairs or in cells, padded cells, because they are so severely mentally ill. And I was told that they cannot be shipped up to Winnebago, just 20 miles away, or a little more than 20 miles away. That's very troublesome.
Yes, and I do not know the answer to that, whether that information is correct, that there is no statutory provision that would allow that. I don't know.
Of course, that's state statutory policy, Department of Corrections. But she was sentenced to imprisonment.
Right.
Confinement.
Yes.
I shouldn't have said imprisonment. I should have said prison.
Prison, yes.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Wallman.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Justice Prosser brought up just one of the things that I was going to bring up, that what in the world would have possessed a defendant to plead guilty to 50 years in prison and not even getting a promise of 50 years, but a possibility of 50 years, possibly even getting 90 years, and as it turns out, he got 80 years, when he had this long history of mental illness going back to when he was 9 years old. And as a matter of fact, we can kind of fault the Milwaukee Mental Health Complex for this whole case, because just a few weeks before this happened, his family took him there
saying he is talking about hearing voices, that he should go and hurt someone. Not anyone in particular, but someone. And in the notes of the hospital, a mental health complex, they wrote he has homicidal ideations. And what did they do? They did not commit him. The next day they released him and told him to go to the clinic. And then this incident happens a few weeks later. And defense counsel said when they went to see him at the jail for the first time, or the first times when they went to see him to discuss the case, he was very disoriented and didn't know what was happening. And it was only after they gave him this Haldol that he, the defense attorney said he became like a different person. He was, his whole life he was hearing voices. He had hallucinations about people being in the room. In fact, when they gave him his Miranda rights, he kept saying to them, listen, I'll talk to you, I'll talk to you, but get this man out of the room. This man is here to hurt me. There was nobody in the room. And that's right on the video. So this man was had very deep mental health issues. And it just does not seem that he would give up this insanity defense that the doctor, Dr. Lighton, had so carefully set forth without without knowing that he could have continued to have a trial on just that defense, even though he was pleading guilty to the charges. But the second thing that I wanted to bring up was I'm a little bit troubled by the Francis case. The Francis case basically held, well, the judge does not have to have this colloquy with the defendant because the right to a jury trial to decide this defense is a statutory right and not a constitutional right. And the fact that the legislature bestowed this right on the defendant rather than the Constitution doesn't make any difference. The legislature in Wisconsin saw fit to give the defendant this right to have the jury decide this defense and give this right to people who might be suffering from a mental illness, just as Wisconsin has always been in the forefront of protecting the rights of the mentally ill. And just because the legislature bestowed that right on the defendant rather than the Constitution doesn't mean that the trial courts may merely ignore it. And that's what I'm saying here. The trial court basically merely ignored it and never mentioned it whatsoever. And in Anderson, this court held that whenever there's a waiver of the right to a jury trial, there must be a colloquy between the defendant and the court, because otherwise this court and the appellate courts cannot know whether or not the waiver had been voluntarily made. And I did not see any exception in Anderson that said, well, you don't have to do this if the right to a jury trial involves the right to a jury trial to decide this defense.
Any questions for Mr. Cole? Ms. Cole? Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel here for their arguments on a case that involves two issues of law that we have had numerous times. And the cases always come up in very different contexts. One, ineffective assistance of counsel. And two, plea colloquies and whether they're defective. So your briefs and arguments have been very helpful. That closes the hearing on 11 AP 150 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Burton. We'll take